Welcome to the Banded About podcast series. Today's guest has been mentioned in many of the previous Engine Room interviews. He taught, ran the drum department, and coordinated regular drum clinics that attracted some of the biggest names in drumming around the world. The store that ran the drum clinics was the iconic Adelaide music store, John Reynolds Music City. And of course, we've already spoken to John Reynolds. So my guest today is the one and only John Stevens. Welcome, John. Thank you for making time to chat with me today. Okay, John, so we're going to start from the beginning. You were born and bred in Adelaide. That's correct, yes?
And then I moved with my mother and father to Burn Street, Brooklyn Park in 1949. And that's where I grew up. And then in 1969, I married my wife and I moved to here in Fulham Gardens, and that's where I've been. I've only had two addresses in my whole life.
Oh, well, that's quite rare. Lots of people normally have quite a few moves in over the years. So
two moves and two jobs my whole life, and I'm now 74.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So were either of your parents involved with music at all?
Yeah, what happened was my parents, we had a radio electrical business called Bell Chambers Radio Electrical, and that was in mid-40s up until 1960. And that was where the Hilton is now, next to the law courts. That was where Bell Chambers was. It was Bell Chambers Radio Electrical. And that's where I spent a lot of my youth in the 50s. Up there because my mother and father run the company, because my mum was a Bell Chambers, and it's right next to where Moores is, or the law courts are now. So I grew up there, and that's where I started my musical sort of career, because we all had we had a record store there and sold radiograms, and so I used to come home and put on 78 records and play along on a little drum that I had, and that was like when I was 2 or 3 years old.
Oh, wow, that's great. Yeah, you must have had an amazing record collection at home then.
Oh, yeah, a lot of them I've still got. We were the first to get LPs, of course, and they were 10-inch in those days, and then they brought out the LP, which is 12-inch. But, so Mum used to say, oh, gee, we're playing a lot of songs on the radio that we've got on records. She didn't realise I was getting the records and putting them on the record player and playing them and playing along to them, yeah.
Wow, that's great.
So that was always been a musical sort of music around because of the accessibility to all of that sort of stuff in those days.
And did you have any music classes when you went to school?
No, I didn't. I was at Lockley's Primary School, and, of course, I was playing then, doing the odd gigs and things like that. They put me in the drum and fife, the drum band. We used to play the drums when the kids would go into school.
Yeah.
You'd play when they marched in, so I did that from grade 3 through to grade 7 when I left, yeah.
All right, yeah. John Yacka last week mentioned the marching into class.
Oh, yes, yeah, you're in the yard and then you had to do the roll, which you rolled on the drums, and that makes everyone have to stand still. And then when you started, you marched up to your classroom door and then marched in. And then on Fridays we used to have a general march day. Because I played with a guy called Patsy Cavallaro at a little concert we had at the school, and I was only in grade 2, I think it was, so I would have been, 7, and played at the concert. And then the next morning, the headmaster said, "Who was that little boy that played in the concert last night?" And I put my hand up and he says, come over here. And he gets the guy that was playing the snare drum. He says, here, you do this. And so I played there, and I was in that from grade two, I think it was, through to grade seven.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
What about high school?
High school, I went to Henley High. Mm-hmm. And we had a bit of a band playing there. But by the time I was in high school, I was playing most Saturday nights anyway.
Mm.
One of my first gigs you'll see on Facebook is the black and white photograph. And that would have been about 1953-54. And that was at a wedding on the Henley Beach Road in a hall, which is just down from the Royal Hotel on Henley Beach Road.
Mm.
And that was at a wedding, and it was a piano and drums. And I got a guinea, £1.01.
Ooh.
which in some bands, that's not much different than what they're getting now.
No. Well, yeah, when you think about it, true.
So that was, and I used to do a lot of little gigs like that. And that was very early in the stage, in the early years.
Mm,
yeah.
Mm. So when did you get your first kit?
It was around about 1954, mm-hmm. And it was bought by my father. He bought it off of Tom Mendonis, which is now Samtath, the seafood people.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a seafood store in Victoria Square next to where Bell Chambers was.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the boys had a drum kit, so my father bought it from him. It was from Johnny Dontis.
Mm. Can you remember what it was?
Yeah, that's the same. That's the one that's in that photograph that I've got on my
Facebook. Oh, right, yeah.
With the big bass drum, yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah, and then I first, the modern sort of kit I bought in 19, Dad bought me in 1960. And that was a premier kit. And then and I had that for quite some time.
Mm.
But, I've had a few kits because I've been working in the shop for 38 years. So I went through a few.
Yeah, well, it would be hard not to buy a new one occasionally, wouldn't it?
I've made a couple of fold-up kits, which you've probably seen on Facebook. I've got those that I use for the small jazz gigs. But the Red Ludwig I had specially made by Ludwig for me in 1983, and I'm still using that one. It's a special dimensions that I had made up because I used to order direct from Ludwig in those days, and I used to actually ring through and ring the order through because there was no emails or anything like that. Not in 1983, there wasn't.
No, there wasn't.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, so who taught you how to play, John?
Oh, no one. No, John. I went to John Reynolds back in 1964. I thought I better maybe learn to read, and I was only there for 4 months, and then John left. And he started his own business. So I was teaching for John from 1968 through to I gave it away completely in 1992 teaching because the shop just got too busy, and I was 7 days a week, as you know.
Yeah.
You know, doing that. So, and I just got, it was from 68 through to 1992, and that's when we moved into the new drum shop, the bigger one.
Mm.
Yeah. But, I never really, most of my, well, the way I used to learn was I'd never sit down and practice the beat and all that sort of stuff. I'd only play along to music. So every time I'd get home from school, I'd put on a record, usually Oscar Peterson or that sort of, I was never into the rock and roll sort of thing.
Mm.
So I used to come along and that's the only way I used to just play along. But I haven't actually... Well, I'm teaching for so long, it's not like you're practicing then, I suppose. Plus, I've virtually played every Saturday night or every week since 1958.
Wow.
Up until now. So, a lot of gigs. But,
so which bands have you played with, John?
Sorry?
Which bands have you played with over the years then?
A lot of different bands. There's none of them have been like the Masters Apprentices or anything like that. There were always sort of a lot of hotels private functions, a lot of residencies. I was 9 years at the called Moby Dick's Tavern in Henley Square, which is now the Thai Orchid. And we were every Friday and Saturday night for 9 years. That's when you actually parked your car in the actual square. And that was from 1970 to 1979. So, and then one of the first regional residencies was down at Lukanurl Football Club. And that was with a group called the Motors. And that was from 65 and 66 and 67. Yeah.
Okay.
And then we, because in those days, there was a lot of residencies about. If you're in a hotel, you were there.
Yeah, well, they used to have a lot of entertainment in the hotels once upon a time.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was the thing. I mean, you get to the hotel on a Saturday night and you say, "How's it all? We're really good tonight. We've got 40 people booked in." Now they don't need the music because they get, you know, every hotel, most hotels, at 7 o'clock on a Saturday or Friday or Thursday night, at 7 o'clock they've got 300, 200 people in there.
Yeah.
You know, the last thing they want is a band blowing their tits off to 12 o'clock. They don't want it. You know, they're all lined up getting their beef parmigiana and their bottle of wine. And by 8:30, they've all gone home. You know? Whereas years ago, we'd be, you know, someone's just bought another jug of beer. That's good. That'll keep us going. It's a different era now, you know.
It certainly is.
And also what's happened is too is that the hotels have been made acoustic nightmares. No curtains, no carpets. So when you go in, the last thing you want is some band playing away, especially if they don't like the song. And it's just not conducive to performances, you know. Even like in the square mile of the city, there's only one place left that actually you can have a dance have a dance, and it's only just in the square mile, and that's on the corner of West Terrace and South Terrace. That's the big hotel on the corner there.
Yeah.
They have to have a dinner dance, and I played there a couple of years ago. I'm like, this is a blast from the past. You know, and carpets on the floor and people nicely dressed up and not look like they've just come from the football. And that's what it was. That's what it was like. But that's all gone. It's all gone. Yeah. But you're back in the early, '50s, my father and his four brothers, we worked at all of the concerts. And I used to go along, Dad used to take me along when in the early 50s, and I always used to sit on the side of the stage, especially Tevin Theatre, used to sit on the side of the stage and watch the drummer, which was, you know, and that was like a couple times a week with all the shows that came to the Tevi Theatre.
Yes, great place.
Oh, yeah. There's thousands of stories. There was one where, I don't know whether you know, Eartha Kitt.
Yes.
Which is a famous sultry singer. Well, I was on the side of at the back of the stage watching, I wasn't watching Eartha Kitt, I was watching the drummer, and it was about a four-piece band. I was very young. It was on about 1954, so I would have been sort of 7 or 8. And Dad come across to me and he says, "Look," he says, "you can actually, you're probably better off if we put you in the box." That's the boxes on the side of the Debbie Theatre. You'll be able to see better there. And I thought, all right, So I go up and I go up into the box watching Eartha Kitt and the band, and then I looked across, and where I was sitting was Dad and his four brothers with their dinner suits with their tongues hanging out where I was sitting. I didn't realise she had a very thin leopard skin dress on, and with the lights coming through, she had no knickers. So they're standing there like four penguins with their tongues hanging out. Well, I wouldn't be able to do anything about it anyway because I was only 8. About 1960, I started ushering there as well. You know, I'm proud to say that I've been to every concert at the Thebe Theatre from probably 1953 through to when we decided to give it away, which was 1983.
Wow. So
I saw every concert, every single concert there because I was working there. And then we also did Centennial Hall, Apollo Stadium, Adelaide Oval, Memorial Drive, and Football Park, and the Town Hall. So we worked at every single concert, like during the 60s at Centennial Hall. I saw the original Roy Orbison. You know, I worked at the Beatles for two nights. I mean, 50 ushers. Mind you, I went home at 9 o'clock because I wasn't into that sort of music. But we all those concerts there. There was hundreds and hundreds, and I'd love to have made a record of it, but you didn't think of it then.
No.
It's fantastic. You know, Polo Stadium, Football Park, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Bee Gees, all those sorts of bands that were there down there. But no, they were good years, very good years.
Mm. So, who were your favourites then?
In the concerts?
Yeah.
Barry White was very good at Centennial Hall. That was very good. Back in the early days, there was Gene Krupa at the Thebe Theatre. Oscar Peterson was at the Centennial Hall. Dave Brubeck was at Centennial Hall. What else? Neil Diamond was very good. Cat Stevens, he was at the Thebe Theatre. That was a very good concert. Pat Metheny was a very good concert. There was a lot of Memorial Drive, which was very good too. That was very good. Because I was never really into, you know, Boss Skaggs was good. I liked Boss Skaggs. And most of these people I met anyway, because before the show, we had to go have a, because we were the security as well in those days, in the early days. The advertiser published a photo back here a couple of years ago of the Beatles, and there's me walking across the front in front of the stage at the bottom because we were the security in those days.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the thing with those in those days, the concerts, you know, that nothing was mic'd up. It was so loud, and you'd spend all this time, especially at Memorial Drive and Thebe Theatre, you spend all the time putting the people into their seats, and as soon as the band started, they just get up and rush to the front of the stage.
Yeah.
So, you know, your G4, no, your G5, and then it was a waste of time. And you couldn't like the Beatles, you couldn't hear anything because they had two columns of speakers. The guy that did it was a guy called Ben Hur, the sound systems. You couldn't hear anything anyway because it was just the screaming and they had nothing mic'd up. You know, so it's not like these days. It's completely full on, beautiful sound these days, you know.
Yeah, I think you'd be pretty pushed to find anyone that went to a Beatles concert that could actually hear the Beatles playing because of the screaming,
Especially all the 60s rock and roll, the Australian bands like the ones from Adelaide, Martha's Apprentices and the Twilights and all that, they were all just screaming, you know. And the thing is, too, people weren't used to the sounds like they have today. You know, they're probably listening to the Beatles going to the concert and it's on an AM radio with a 6-inch speaker in their holding. Now, when they go to the gig, if they're listening to something in the car, it's, you know, they've got 2,000 watts. It's just totally different.
We did the
Bill Haley concert in the very early 50s at the old Tivoli, which is now the Her Majesty's Theatre. And all he had, Bill Haley, all he had, my father did the sound from Bell Chambers. We had a 25-watt Philips amp and two 12-inch speakers. That was all. And he said it was the best sound they'd had in Australia. It's just so far different now, you know.
Sure is.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about your time with the John Reynolds Store.
Yeah, right. Well, when John left Gary Haynes, because Gary went under, so John started up, and that was just after I started to come to him to learn to read. And he said, look, do you want to come and teach? Because I was working, I only had two jobs. I had it started in 1962 at Pettit Hardware, and I was there till 1978, and then I joined John full time. But in 1968, John said, do you want to come and teach? So I used to teach Wednesday nights and Saturday afternoons after I finished work at the hardware store. And I used to teach there in the old shop, which is next to the Grace Emily, which was it's only a barber shop, and we used to teach there in the back of the shop. And then John decided to buy up Spurden's, which was up the road where the present situation is now. So I used to come and help him on weekends, set everything up. And then in 1978, he said, can you come and work in the shop? So I decided to leave the job that I'd been with since 1962 and started working in the drum shop. And I was there till 2013.
That's a long time, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, but I enjoyed it. I mean, John gave me full reins, especially over the last 25 years. He gave me full reins, and I used to go overseas every year with Gary Hyde. He used to take me over as a guest to Anaheim, to the music fair in Los Angeles, and then we'd go to Frankfurt after that. And I went to all the factories over the years, the Zildjian factory, the Pearl factory, Tama factory, Yamaha, went to all those factories. So it gave me an insight into the music industry and met a lot of people, of course, naturally. But then we started doing clinics, and that was the big thing. That's what really put John Reynolds on the map, was the drum clinics. I did them all. I arranged them and contacted everyone, and fantastic. I mean, one of the biggest ones was at the Old Lion. I had 950 to see Dave Weckl. That was a lot of people.
Wow.
And I had, about a month later, I had 650 for Chester Thompson. He played for Genesis. And that was 650 there. And I had 650 at the Italian Club for Simon Phillips. But then we did a lot of clinics at the Highway Inn, which was probably one of the main ones we did. And that was through the 80s. Got to meet all the drummers, and most of them were very, very easy to get along with, you know. I mean, they were glad to come out to Australia because they're earning bugger all in America, same as the public, earning nothing now, you know. So they come out to Australia and pick themselves up 30 or 40 grand just to go in and play a few paradiddles. And that's where they came over. A lot of them were brought over by the drum manufacturers. But then I used to do the Drummers Grand Prix every year at the Highway Inn, and that was the weekend before the Formula One Grand Prix. And it was always for local drummers. And I had about five, I think it was. I've got all these videos, all these clinics on DVD because I had them transferred from video. So I've got them, probably 60 or 70 of them on DVD. But I used to do the Drummers Grand Prix, which is featuring all local drummers, and that was good. It was a lot of work though, because I'd be working till 12 o'clock at the gig, at my own gig, and then we'd go down to the Highway Inn and start pulling down all the stuff that was for Grabber Granny was there on Saturday nights, and we'd go back to the shop and bring all the stuff from the shop. Set it all up. We'd work from 1 o'clock in the morning through till 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the Sunday afternoon, put on the clinic, and then pack it all up and then go home. And I'd get home at, say, 12 o'clock that night. And it's a long day. And I did it for about 5 years, and then thank goodness we lost the Formula One Grand Prix in 95, so I didn't have to do it anymore. Thank Christ for that. No, but I enjoyed doing it, you know, and that's how all the drummers, I got to know all the drummers, because everyone came in to buy the drum clinic tickets, and I used to put out a newsletter every month that my daughter used to help, and John's daughter, and we used to post out 500 or 600 letters every couple of months, put them in the post and fold them all up, because it's not done now. You know, it's easier to do it now, but they don't do it. All you do is do an email and just press a button, but it's just not done now.
Yeah.
Drummers used to like it. I used to mention different things that they bought and have different sections through the news. It was about a four-page newsletter that we used to do, type it all up and then print it out on the photocopier and then put it in the envelopes and post them off. A lot of work.
Yeah.
A lot of work.
Yeah. Manual mail outs, yeah, I don't miss that, that's for sure. So, do you have any a memorable story that you'd like to share from the drum clinics that you ran? I know John shared the one with about the Red Hot Chili Peppers. So you don't need to say that one.
Oh no, he was right. I could tell you more about it. But on the Chad Smith one, that was memorable because it was Chad Smith from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and he was smoking and drinking a beer, and then he threw away the tickets, which was, he shouldn't have done, you know.
Mm.
But he made up for it because he took. Well, I didn't go. I must admit, I didn't go. But he took the rest of the boys to the Crazy Horse and spent $2,000. Greg Bissonette was here, and he wanted to go out for lunch, so we took him to Cobb's in Light Square.
Mm.
That's the one where they had the topless waitresses.
Mm-hmm.
So he came in, and, of course, they mentioned that he was with James Lee Roth, and all the girls were all over him. You know, they didn't bother about me. They're all over him. And we were so late leaving that he almost missed his plane to go to Perth. But then when he left, he'd forgotten the thimbles. He'd left the thimbles at the shop. So we had to do an emergency send over because he had the clinic the following night, so we had to get an emergency send the thimbles over. But he was great. He was probably one of the easiest ones. Him and Dennis Chambers, they were really good. But there's been so many drummers. We used to do probably 20 clinics a year.
Mm.
And then also back in the 90s, Vorticity, which was a promotion company run by Frank Corniola, who owns Drum Tech, he used to bring over all these concerts, and I used to organise all those. And we used to get 450, 500, and in the end, they were about $40 a ticket.
Mm.
We used to organise all those. A lot of work involved in getting, especially at the Arkaba, so you got to take everything up the stairs. It's a lot of work. But I enjoyed it. But there was a lot of shows there. And then when that finished, we started going to the Governor High March. The days of the drum clinics are gone, I think, because it was hard enough getting towards the end of, because what you do is you say, oh, so-and-so's coming out. Oh, and I've seen him on YouTube, and that's the problem. Whereas people used to come in, oh, what's the latest Dave Weckl video? We want to buy that, you know.
Yeah.
So I think you interviewed Mario Marino. Well, he was my biggest customer for books and DVDs.
Was he?
I never used to buy anything else, but he bought all the books and DVDs. Mm. He's hundreds and hundreds of, thousands of dollars worth of stuff. Every time he'd come in, there'd be $400 or $500 because he'd buy all the latest DVDs and the books. Whereas now they don't even bother. They just don't do it.
Yeah. No, Mario's interview is the most popular one out of all of them.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I saw it. You did Jeff Aldra.
Yes.
And, all my customers. And when we had the farewell to John Reynolds shop, because they're pulling it down, so we organised a get-together in the Light Square.
Mm.
And it was only about a couple of months ago. And we had about 70 guys there, so I got up and spoke, because John said, you do the speaking. And so I thanked everyone for coming there, and I said, look, I've all these smiling faces. I said, this is the last time we will have this group of drummers together, because there's all the notable drummers were there, naturally.
Yeah.
And Brad Palames and Jim Bailey's and all the you know, what I would class now as the top drummers.
Mm.
And I said, oh, it's good to see so many familiar faces. This is the last time that we'll have this group together. And they all, yeah. Because I used to have a party at the end of every year for all the drummers at the top. So I said, as I look across these very familiar faces, quite a lot of you still owe John some money. Well, they just... because they're expecting me to be rude, because that's what they used to bring them in. They said they love the service and the abuse we used to get. Doesn't happen now.
Oh dear. So who are your three top local drummers?
I would say Steve Todd, Brad Pullane. I don't want to put anyone out, they're very busy and very good. Of course, Ben Todd. I could go on and on. Oh, John McDermott, he teaches at the uni. He's a very, very good drummer. I heard Chris Neal the other night playing with Samantha and Dennis Sheridan and Hugh Sheridan. Very good drummer, yeah.
Mm.
And of course, me, of course.
Of course. That's really, nobody else has said that.
I should have met you. Yeah. Well, when you say, what are the drummers that's most influenced you? Me. Why not?
Why not indeed?
Yeah.
So you've taught a lot of people.
Oh, yes. Olivia Baffelli.
Mm-hmm.
You did him, yeah, Olivia. I saw him, I was in Derringer's the other day and he walked in and, oh, John, because when I walk into Derringer's, usually there's a customer and they all think I'm going to be working there.
I heard you did a bit of a time behind the counter at Billy Hyde's.
Yes. Well, Jerry, I sold him his first kit, Jerry from Derringer's.
Yeah.
And there's a photo of me selling him the kit at John Reynolds, so we took a photo of him in front of the counter and me behind the counter, you know. But I went and saw Brad at the new Billy Hyde store, and when I went in there were four guys in there. Oh, John.
Yeah.
It's just that there's a lot of, I mean, it's now been 2013, so it's almost 8 or 9 years since I've actually been in the shop serving customers. So, you know, in that nine, there's a lot of new guys who come along. You know, and I don't know them, but because quite a lot, I look a lot of bands on Facebook, and a lot of the guys I don't know because they're getting older. I mean, they're not 74; they're only probably 20. You know.
Yeah. Always new drummers coming. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, too, is that with music, there's not too many hobbies or professions that people are prepared to pay you money to do what you were doing when you were, or like me, when I was seven, and they're still prepared to pay you to do what you're doing when you're 74.
Mm.
I can't think of an accountant maybe. Oh, no, you wouldn't be an accountant when you're seven.
No, you wouldn't, no. Unless you're some sort of mathematical whiz kid, yeah.
But it's a fantastic profession that you can still do what you love, and let's face it, most of it they think they're professional musicians, but in the end it's sort of maybe a hobby, because the idea of actually earning a full time living off of playing is not as easy as what it was. Even in the old days, you had to work 7 nights a week at a nightclub or something like that, but. Nowadays, it's harder and harder to get a residency. You've got to do jobs all over the place.
Yeah, you do.
It's not an easy profession, and I've seen so many drummers come in from Adelaide. You know, they're going to go to Melbourne, or they're going to go to Sydney, or the, you know, a lot of them are back in 3 weeks. What happened to England? Oh, it's closed.
Closed, yeah.
So, and I've seen it so many times, and a lot of times parents have come in to me, oh, look, so-and-so wants to go to Sydney, what do you think? You know, and then 6 months later they come in, oh, you were right, he's into drugs or whatever it might be, you know.
Mm.
It's a very hard industry because you've got to go through certain doors to get to where what you want to do. It doesn't matter whether you want to be an accountant or a racing car driver or a muso. There are certain doors that you've got to go through, and behind those doors are the traps.
Yeah.
And then, of course, with a muso, behind that door are the same traps for everyone. And that's where that's when they can go off the boil. That's the problem. I've seen it so many times over the years.
Mm.
You know, if you get influenced by the bass player or the guitarist or the piano player, you know.
Yeah.
And it still amazes me, especially in the older fields, the older musos, that they still want to drink on the job. And it makes it so hard because, you know, you don't sell shoes at Myers and have a break for 10 minutes and go and have a drink, whereas it's just the nature of the industry.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, as soon as you have a break, I'll just go and get a drink. Mm. You know, if you're an ambulance driver or, as I said, if you sell shoes at Myers, oh, let's have a break. Oh, let's go have a drink. You don't do that.
No, you don't.
No, because there's no bar there.
True.
Yeah.
So who have you taught that's gone on to have reasonable success?
No one. Travis Sagani, I taught him for a little while.
Yeah, he's a fabulous drummer.
He worked for me. Mm. Yeah. Olivia Baselli, he's still gigging. I really haven't taught anyone that's actually gone on overseas to earn a living. Mm. It's mainly just local guys.
Yeah,
a lot of local guys. You know, it's when you teach from 68 through to a lot of students. You know, and like a lot of the times, they'll go for a couple of years and then they'll give it away. You know, but quite often I'll be playing and then some guy will come up. Looks as old as me. He says, "Oh, you taught me." Because when he mentions his name, bing, it rings a bell, you know.
Yeah.
But because I haven't aged, that's why they know me. You see that?
Oh yeah. You look like you're 19. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been a fantastic. Fantastic era, and I've played with a lot of bands. And the thing is, I've always played a lot of different styles. You can't restrict yourself because otherwise it restricts your playing, restricts the jobs that you've got. I've always played, and I've never really been in bands that rehearse. Like Tuesday nights at the jazz club, we're getting 160 people every week. It's been going for 20-odd years. I do there most Tuesday nights with different bands.
Mm.
And it's usually a 6 or 7 or an 8-piece band, and we all get paid good money. And you don't know who you're playing with and what you're going to play until you get on the stage.
Yeah.
You know, and because most of the songs, most of the songs anyway, and if you don't, it's easy to pick up. And they're all good musos, so you don't really know what you're doing until they go, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, and where you go. That's it.
Yep.
Whereas other bands, they're madly rehearsing Green Door or something like that. It's a different mindset altogether.
Mm.
Different mindset, you know.
If you could offer one tip to a brand new drummer, what would it be?
Make sure you answer your mobile. That's the main thing, because that is very important. I heard from someone who said that. I said, no, none of the young ones answer their mobile. And she said, no, they won't. Because I said, why not? Because if they do answer it, they have to make a commitment.
Mm.
Where they want to have it, they want to have it so that the options are open. So I deal with a lot of younger musos, and they know now I've got this thing about mobile, so as soon as I ring, oh, g'day, John, before, you'd ring, you'd leave a message, you'd text them about a gig or something like that, and they wouldn't get back to you.
Mm.
But most of them do now because they know I've got this fetish about answering. Mind you, if they're only 20 or 20 to 30s, If there's still music in 50 years' time, I'm sure they will. If they're still playing, they'll definitely answer their mobile if they want to get a gig. That's the problem. Mm. It's just so easy not to answer your phone.
Yeah, you would think that at the moment with, you know, the situation trying to recover from the COVID shutdown that more of them would be answering their phone.
No, it's just not important to them. You know, you even text them and they won't answer. Not all of them, some will. Some of them won't answer, you know. It's just not right.
No.
But, and I would say try and play as much variety as you can. I mean, when I started playing, I was playing with the German band, the Italian band. I was with the Filipino band for a long, long time. Fantastic musos. I learned a lot off of them. But playing all different varieties. The only one I never got into was a Greek band, but I was in the German club for quite a while, in the old mill up at Harndorf. That was the playing up there. Italian bands, Latin stuff. And in the last few years, I've been doing rock and roll, the rock and roll scene, 50s and 60s rock and roll, which is good.
Mm.
But my first love is sort of Brazilian music, or not feverish Brazilian, bossa nova type stuff. And that's where, that's my first love, but no one wants to listen to it now, unless you're in the lift.
And you haven't got a choice, yeah.
Girl from Ipanema, yeah, which is the best song ever written. But when I go for my drives, like I did 500K yesterday for my son, I had Antonio Carlos Jobim's Tidal Wave playing, which is the one that was in 1970s. I just like listening to that. The last thing I want to do is listen to, you know, a pop thing or a pop thing, you know.
Yeah.
I just want it relaxing. So it's just a different era.
So how did COVID affect what you do nowadays, John?
When COVID hit, which was the 23rd of March, I did my last gig on the 21st. That was a private function up at Hague's Chocolates, and that was with the jazz band. When that hit, within a week, I'd lost 40 gigs because there was a lot of, and of course the Southern Jazz Club finished, all the rock and roll things had finished, and I had a lot of corporate shows. I do corporate shows at the Hyatt, sorry, not the Hyatt, the Intercontinental or the Adelaide Oval, the casino, that sort of stuff. That all got cancelled. And also I'm the only one doing drum repairs at schools, and that's quite a big part of my business is doing drum repairs and also guys calling into my house because I got all the spare parts from the shop. I'm here, so I've got a big workshop, and I do all the drum repairs. So a lot of that stuff stopped because the schools were on the back burner, and also my process serving with my son. We were doing 1,000 jobs a month. We had nothing, and now of course it's come back with a vengeance. It's really come back. As I said, I did 500K yesterday. Up at Clare and Barra, Kapunda, all up around that area, yeah. But it's all coming back now, and that's good. The music scene's coming back now. They've got unlimited people now, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And people can dance cool. again?
Yes, yeah. Although they have been dancing for a while. it's good to see. And actually, the Southern Jazz Club, we've been getting 160 people every week. They're all, and they had no problems with people when it was full on. They had no problems with people standing up and drinking because most of our patrons can't stand up anyway. So by the time they get up, the gig's over. But they actually said, do we want dancing back? They said, no, we don't want to lose. We'll get more people in if we don't have the dance floor, which was very strange. You know, their age group is sort of 70 to death age group. So, and they're very appreciative, you know, and they clap after every solo because every song is probably 10 minutes long because by the time you get an 8-piece band all trying to do a solo and that. So it's very good. But there's a few young ones coming into it now. Mainly because there's a few young ones coming in playing in the band. There's some great young musicians now, you know, bass players and guitarists, trombone players and sax players and piano players. They're very, very good because they've got to have someone to continue on.
Well, yes.
Yeah. The other night I did a gig with at the Adelaide Oval with Jason Hammond, Paul Vanderkoff, and a young bass player called Henry Francis.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 19, and he did not look at the music once. It was just, I thought he was fantastic. Yeah. He's actually playing next week at the Jazz Club. But, you know, 19 and double bass player, which is a hard instrument to play.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another young, Solomon Young. He plays saxophone and vibraphone, and very good player, you know. The other night I did a gig with him. He says, "Would you mind, John, if I don't read any music, just lug it?" All right. And it's stuff that, you know, it's pretty intricate stuff. It's not three chords. It's quite intricate, some of the stuff they do.
Mm.
But it's full marks to the teachers that are teaching them.
Yeah, no, it's great. If you could invite any musician to play a concert with you, being on the kit,
yeah,
anywhere in the world,
mm-hmm,
who would you call? Where would it be held? And what genre would the band be performing?
Alive or dead people?
Anyone you like. You can resurrect them for this.
Well, I'd like to do a gig at the Festival Theatre.
Mm-hmm.
With Antonio Carlos Jobim, who was the composer of all of the Latin stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to have Samantha, who I work with, Samantha Vanua, do the vocals.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be on drums, of course.
Yes.
And just some of the local players to play piano, Jason Hammond or Tony Lily White. Bass player Malush, Jeff Miller. The main thing is, when I've always played, I've never really listened to the rhythms. I always play to the vocalist. That's the way when I'm playing. If there's a vocalist, my whole concentration is on the vocalist. That's, to me, that's the way that I play. It's if you can hear the bass player, the idea to me, a good bass player is not having to worry about where he is. He should should just flow along.
Mm.
And that's the main thing, is if the bass player is in good tune, that to me is the ultimate, because then you don't have to concentrate, because then you can listen to the piano player or listen to the vocalist.
Yeah.
That's the thing, yeah.
What do you do when things are going wrong?
Oh, just laugh. No, to be honest, there's not too much that goes wrong with the bands that I'm in, because they're all sort of professional players. One thing I might mention, I was at the Newmarket Hotel for about 12 years with the All-Stars. This is the old Eddie White All-Stars.
Mm.
And if people wanted to get up, we'd always ask them, you know, they can get up. So this guy came over and he said, "Look, my girlfriend's a singer and she'd like to sing a song." I said, "Yeah, that's all right." Mm. So get her up. So she came up and she mentioned this song, which no one knew except Jason Hammond, said, "Oh, all it is just a 12-bar blues in G."
Mm.
And she says, "Oh, no, it's not." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" She says, "Well, it goes longer than 12 bars." She had a very good voice, but unfortunately, when we got to the 12th bar, we stopped. Just for a joke, you know.
Yeah.
But she was quite serious. She says, "Look," she says, "oh, no, it's not." She said, "Well," I said, "what do you mean?" Well, Jason said, "What do you mean?" She says, "Well, it goes longer than 12 bars."
Oh, God. Oh, that's very funny.
Yeah. There's a million stories like that. Gosh,
well, go ahead, share some more. That's what you're here for.
I was doing a wedding at the Norwood Redlegs Clubs with my trio that I had for about 30-odd years, Motivation. And it got to the end of the bridal, wish me luck, the circle. And an old woman sitting at the table, she started to have a confrontation with the bride, and come about that she said, no, she says, I'm not getting up for you for this. And she was a bit of a problem. So it come to a head where the bride's mother and the bridesmaid and this woman finished up, and the bride finished up wrestling on the floor. So I rushed upstairs and got Terry Lindblom, who was running the Redlegs disco upstairs. He came down and bounced them out of the room. This was in the blue room downstairs at the Norwood Club Rooms. And he bounced them out. And the problem was they were going through it all the next week because the bridesmaid was getting married.
So the same ones are coming back.
There was another one. We did a wedding at the Festival Theatre Banquet Room, the one at the front, which we did a lot of weddings there. And come to Auld Lang Syne, and everyone's up in the middle of the floor. And I said to Ralph, the keyboard player, I thought, look at that bird that's just come in. Look at her. She must be a friend of the bride. So we saw her come in, and she had these tight jeans on. And this was back in the 80s, or early 90s, sorry. And then when they all went back to their seats, this was just after the casino, was it when the casino had started? So it would have been late 80s. They went back to get their sit down, and then one woman said, oh, where's my bag? And next thing, the next woman said, where's my bag? What this bird had done while they're up waltzing around for Auld Lang Syne, she came in, knocked off about a dozen handbags, took them into the toilets and emptied them out, because everyone used to bring along money to go to the casino.
Yeah, oh, my God.
And there's all the bags ripped apart in the women's toilets, and she'd been in and cleaned them out.
Wow.
She actually had to walk right past everyone to do it because the toilets were right on the other side of the room. So she was game, but no one noticed it because they're all up there.
Everyone was busy. Gee, she had that well planned, didn't she?
Where's my bag? Yeah, there's a couple of months, but there's thousands of memories after all these years. But I did the wrestling for 9 years at the Tebby Theatre.
Yeah.
Every Monday night, and that was run by my uncle. He run it, and we used to take the wrestlers back to the airport motel. And this particular night, Uncle Darkie, the one that was run the whole thing, he says, can you take the Masked Marauder back to the airport motel? Don't forget to call into Birdland on the Hanging Beach Road and pick up two chickens and a litre of orange juice. I said, that's okay, because he said, we've got an account there. So I had a little Fiat 125 in those days. So the Masked Marauder comes out with all his uniform on, his outfit on with the mask and the boots and the cape. And he says, I can't take this off, John. He says, it's all part of my contract. I said, that's all right. So I jammed him in the front of the Fiat. We went down to the Birdland. It's still there, actually. He said, you go and get it. I won't get out. So I went in, because if you ushered a new work, you had to wear a dinner suit, which is not on these days, but even when you did a gig, you wore a dinner suit. So I go in to get the chickens, and as I'm coming out, the door onto Henley Beach Road was blocked. There's these kids with their bikes up against them. And they're pulling the piss out of me, saying, oh, don't we look lovely in our suit, Next thing I see, they looked around, and there's the Masked Marauder, got out of the Fiat, coming towards them. Well, he says, you having trouble, John? I think they're still going. This would have been about 1975.
Okay. Yeah, that would have been a bit of a scare for them.
But, that were good years, the wrestling. It was very hot in there, though, gee, there was no air conditioning in those days. But I see they're doing up the foyer.
Yeah.
Of the Febby Theatre, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because Bob Lott still owns that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he got that. He used to have Central Booking Agency.
Yeah.
Which is the entertainment agency. And I think he's still got it, yeah. But, I spent hundreds and hundreds of shows there. Like, especially in the 60s, I mean, I was at Centennial Hall probably twice a week with all the rock bands from England coming across, the Monkees, Tom Jones, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, every week. And then there was the American side of it as well, Roy Orbison, Johnny Cash. They all came there, and it was just every week. There was one or two nights a week I was there with my dinner suit on, ushering there. Fabulous memories, but unfortunately, I should have written them down, but you don't, you know, it's all bygone, you know, that's 50 years ago.
There's still time to write a book.
No, I tell you, it'd have to be on asbestos paper, some of the stories. When Duke Ellington was at Centennial Hall and he said, I need some sugar. This is the big band leader.
Mm.
He says, I want some sugar. So I was sent across the road. There was a little deli across the road. So I had to go and buy, a bag of sugar. So I went back and gave him the sugar, and he had a Coke. He poured it into a glass, and then he got the sugar and half filled the glass with sugar.
Oh, my God.
I don't know why. And that's what he wanted.
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. Yuck.
Yeah.
Coke is sweet enough, isn't it, surely?
I know. He had two or three teaspoons of sugar in a glass of Coke.
Dang.
Yeah, that would have been probably 72, I suppose, something like that. Yeah, yeah. I've been very happy and very fortunate being in the shop because I met so many people and so many lovely customers. I mean, they're all my best friends. Even now, I at the end of every year, I put on a luncheon at the Watermark Hotel.
Mm.
I didn't do it last year because of COVID, but I'll do it again this year. And I ring everyone. So it's about 300 to 400 phone calls I ring. And I get – the original thing was 70 to death age group, all the old musos, but I'm now including younger ones to come in, when I say younger people in their 50s and 60s, because every year we lose probably 10 guys. Even this year we've lost three guys that would normally come. So I ring them, invite them along to the Watermark Hotel, and we meet in the sports bar, and I get about 100 guys, and I book out a certain section of the Watermark. And then we meet in the sports bar, and then we all waddle over into the Watermark, into the main room, and they have the smorgasbord. So I've got to go and see them in a couple of months' time to find out what the situation is this year, because there's no more self-serve, I don't think, now. I'm not sure.
But I'm sure it'll probably come back, but, yeah, it depends on how everything keeps going.
I need to know, because it's a lot of work making 350 phone calls.
Because
I've got nearly 1,000 phone numbers in my phone, which they're all the musos. So a lot of people ring me and say, oh, have you got so-and-so's phone number? Yeah, I've got it. And I just send it on to them. But
guy I was supposed to be contacting then about phone numbers.
Yes, yeah. The thing is that some say, oh, why don't you just text them? I said, bloody hell, if a 20-year-old won't answer a text, the bloody 90-year-old guy's not going to answer a text. So when I'm at a gig, especially the whole way in, I say, oh, if I want to make a photograph, I've got to try and find someone young enough who can actually work a phone to take a photo.
I can relate to this because my dad came over from New South Wales for a few days to catch up and to meet his very first great-grandchild, and he recently got a new phone and he couldn't operate it. So we had to teach him how to do things like send a text message and stuff like that. It was just like he was just so confused about how to use it. It was hilarious.
Yeah, a bit like me today, trying to get onto you.
Yes.
Goodness knows what happened there. Anyway, yeah.
Oh, well, John Reynolds will get a good laugh out of that because he managed to do it first time.
Accident.
Might have been, but it doesn't matter.
We used to do a lot of weddings at Fernley Lodge, And we went out there and set all the gear up. And I said, gee, this is all set up for a wedding. And I said, gee, there's not many people about. And so we set the keyboard up and the drums and the PA and all that. It was a wedding in Fernley Lodge, that's where I got married. Then the guy was walking through and I said, oh, gee, what's happening? He says, what are you here for? And I said, well, we've come here for the wedding. And he says, no. I said, well, it's all set up. He says, no, that's for tomorrow or something like that. That was for last night or something like that. And I said, oh, well, it's the 21st of February. He says, no, 21st of March, because the dates are exactly the same in February and March.
Mm.
The days and the dates are exactly the same. Yeah. And I'd got it wrong. Luckily.
You're a month early.
Yes. Oh, God. We had to pack everything up and go home and then go back the following month.
Oh, gosh. That's real clever.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was in the Italian band, we used to do a lot of weddings, and we're at Centennial Hall. There was 800 people for the wedding. And the phone rings on the stage, so I picked it up, and it was the bass player, Fred Fernando Martin. And he said, oh, look, I can't come tonight. I can't do the gig, because he was off with his girlfriend. And so we had a piano accordion, a trumpet, and drums. That was all. So they made an announcement over the PA, and next thing, about 20 bass players put their hand up, and some of them had their gear in the car, so they filled out. But I mean, the phone rings on the Centennial Hall stage, and the bass player, oh, I can't come. Oh, there was another one. I was playing with an Italian band on Monday night out at the Freeway Hotel, which is now the Bridgeway.
Mm.
And we used to do a Latin night on Monday nights, and that's when they had the Starlight Room, where they had the stage that went underneath the main stage.
Yeah.
It was electrically operated, so they pressed the button. So because it was a Latin night and there wasn't many people there, they had the stage. The bottom part was out. So we set out the front on the stage that actually retracted. We're on the front stage for the to do the thing, because the people were sort of sitting in an intimate thing. We were playing, you know, all the Latin Italian songs, you know. So about halfway through the night, next thing I thought, gee, what's that something's happened. Someone had ran around the back and pressed the bloody button. The stage started going back in underneath the main stage. So there we've got an organ, a piano, organ, guitarist, saxophone, drums, and a singer and a guitarist. And gradually, as the stage is going in, everything's falling off. Because we're in a break, and then we're looking up, and there's the... I said, the stage is moving. And of course, they're all going, that's not what is in order. They're trying to tell each other to turn it off, and everything's falling off.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. That was about probably 63, 64. Yeah.
Wow. Lucky you weren't on there, right?
No. We're having a break, and we looked up, and somebody said, is that stage moving? I said, yes, it is. I said, some idiots pressed the bloody button. Because they're all back trying to decipher how to turn it off, and of course, they're all panicking. And luckily the organ was at the back, and it didn't get to that. We turned it off, but the guitar and a couple of the drums, the saxophone and the bass player, that stuff, they're on little stands, you know,
because
they dropped over the edge. It was only about 2 feet high, I suppose, maybe 3 foot high.
Mm.
But that used to be when people used to have performances and the stage would go back underneath, which is not done now, of course.
No.
Probably
a good thing that it's not done now, right? John, what do you hope to have achieved before you lay down the sticks for the last time?
Just keep going the way I am. I'm hoping that if I get too old to play, I know when to stop. I know that probably, if I do get too old, my wife will be out there looking for another gig for me to go to. last New Year's Eve was only the second New Year's Eve I've had off in 58 years. I've played New Year's Eve 58 years, except for the last 2 years. Last year wasn't on because of the COVID.
Mm.
And I didn't do the year before, but I've done 58. So really, I've never really spent a New Year's Eve. We've been married 51 years or 52 years in June, but she's, you know, I've got three lovely kids, and we've got four grandchildren, and they're all, you know, quite successful, and they come over every Wednesday night for Wednesday night's tea. My wife got pancreatic cancer June last year, and we thought that we'd lost her. She had breast cancer 23 years ago, and she survived that. But now she's got pancreatic cancer, but she's recovering, and she's off. Right, she loves riding bikes, and so she's been riding 30 and 40 k every day. So she's still only 54 kilos. She was 74.
Yeah.
So she's they call her the gutless wonder because she had a Whipple operation, which is a very severe cancer operation, bowel cancer, pancreatic. So, but no, she's only just got back from a walk now. She went walking with some girls. But, I just like to keep playing as long as I can. Hopefully, there's a few old musos that should have given it away, you know, and I said to some guy the other day, I said, gee, I just hope I play as bad as him when I'm 90. Meaning that, you know, they're still up there playing, you know. It's just amazing. The main thing is that when I retired, sort of retired, I'm still mixing with people, and I like mixing with people. And I've got guys coming all the time with getting repairs done. I go to the schools. I know all the teachers there. I get on very well with them. I'm first names with all of them. So I like that, and I like doing the gigs. So I've got all these facets, and now with my effective process serving, I'm meeting a totally different clientele, but it's all in the way you approach them, you know. If you're going to serve a divorce paper, you don't still say their full name, you just say their first name. You know, hi, Di, I've got a $100 million check here for you. You don't approach them. Mind you, I've got age on my side, so you can get away with murder. Like what we used to do in the shop. Bloody hell, I'd be arrested for what we used to do in the John Reynolds, all the mucking around we used to do. It's gone overboard though these days. All this righteousness and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, no one's got any character anymore.
What gigs do you do on a regular basis now? I know you do the one at the Tea Tree Gully RSL on the Sundays.
Yes, there's the Southern Jazz Club, which I do regular, and then there's a lot of corporate type show. Like last Saturday night, I filled in for Peter Harris at the for the Rhythm Cats. It was a rock and roll thing.
Yeah.
I did that one, and then I'm doing it again this Sunday at a dance club in Goodger Street. I've been working with the Fernanda Brothers for 20 odd years, and we did the Southern Jazz Club a fortnight ago, and that's Mike and Steve Fernanda. And I've been with them for a long, long time. I'm also doing gigs with the Adelaide Jazz Trio, then my own band with Samantha, that's with Tony Lily White and Jeff Miller. We do gigs like that. I do a bit of fill-in work for Bill Parton when he wants to do a gig here in Adelaide, because he lives in Melbourne, so he gets me to organise it, organise the liaise with the people doing the gig. So I do those sorts of things. As people know, I'm a slut. I'll play with anyone. It doesn't matter what colour or what breed or what sort of music, I will play it. You have to. If you get selective, I want to do regionals, or I only want to do, you know, heavy metal or whatever it might be, you're restricting your life expectancy, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
No, it is.
No, it's true.
But A lot of kind of people saying, do you play originals? I say, yeah, the original songs I did in the 50s. Or do you play covers? Yeah, 78s.
Oh, dear.
The thing is, too, is that music has changed a lot. You go to a pub or something like that and you've got a guy with a very good voice singing songs and I don't know them, you know? It's strange. I said to my wife the other day, we were somewhere, and I said, what's that song? It sounds like he's reading out the instruction manual for a DVD player, because it didn't really click, you know? And if I like to look around and see who's actually in the hotel or restaurant, he's probably singing the songs that they probably don't know either.
Mm.
You know, it's just a strange situation.
Yeah,
you know?
Some people don't really think much about the crowd that's going to be there.
No, that's right. Mm. I mean, you've got your other venues which cater for a certain style of music, like the Gaslight. There's all the guys go down there and they have a good, great time playing.
Yep.
But whether you'd actually book them to play in a hotel, I don't know. I don't know.
Mm.
They're all good musos, and the sounds are good. But it's whether you've got to play what the people want. If you don't play what the people want, as I say, NCV, no commercial value.
Mm.
It's all very well to learn all this fancy stuff, like some of the drummers. You know, they're learning all this fancy, intricate times and all that. You know, it's very, very difficult, but being quite rude, it's a bit like learning to have sex in a hammock. You can't, if you do learn it, you can't find anyone that wants to do it with you.
Yeah.
Well, I can do this. Yeah, but I don't want to. I just want to do it on the bed. Oh, no, I can do it in a hammock. that's the same with a lot of the music, especially the drummers. You know, they're learning page 68 out of the Dave Weckl book. Why? Why would you bother? You know? You know, they did learn all that, and then they get on the bandstand, and what's he going to play? Mustang Sally. Oh, all right. you can't be too overqualified. You can be too overqualified. That's what I mean.
Mm, mm.
Because the average audience, they're not listening to it the way you listen to it. They listen to it what they like. That's why the 50s and 60s rock and roll is so popular, because you have to play it exactly like. If you do a 12-bar guitar solo, you lose them. They don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Got no idea. But whereas the jazz club, I don't know what they're listening for, because half the time I don't even know what they're playing.
Yeah.
But you know, after every solo, they all clap. You know, every doesn't matter, you know, who's soloing, they clap after every solo.
Mm. Mm.
You must come down one night and have a listen.
I will. I will. Yeah. Yeah.
Get you up to sing. Get you up to sing.
Okay. Done.
we'll do a 12-bar blues for you.
I can sing more than 12 bars. Boom, boom.
Yeah. Oh, no, we don't want you. We don't want anything technical. We don't want smart asses.
No. Oh, okay. No, that sounds like a great idea. I'll do that.
Let me know and I'll get you on.
All right.
As long as it's in G.
Oh, only in G. Okay. Before we end our chat today, I'm going to ask John 20 quick random questions, or as many as we can get through in the space of 2 minutes to close the interview. Are you ready, John? Your time starts now. Name the first concert that you went to.
Probably Gene Krupa.
Name a band you wish you hadn't seen perform live.
I don't know.
Pass?
Yeah, pass.
Favourite book?
Ian and Blight and Five Go Off in a Caravan.
Who is your favourite superhero?
Superman.
Name your favourite song from the 60s.
Girl from Ipanema.
Who famously performed his signature tune in 1980 hit movie The Blues Brothers?
Don't know.
Who did the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame dub as the most recorded drummer in history?
Hal Blaine.
Correct. Favourite day of the week?
Saturday.
Name something that you can't live without.
My wife and my car.
What is your preferred brand of drumsticks?
Verisonic, which I've used for 50 years.
What was the last concert that you went to?
Last Thursday night with Dennis Sheridan, Hugh Sheridan and Samantha.
The most sticks that you've dropped during a gig?
Two, I suppose.
If you could trade places with anyone for one day, who would it be?
Don't know.
Name a song that you hate playing.
Please release me.
What is your pet hate?
People who don't answer their phone.
It is too. Okay, hang on, let me just stop that. We've run out of time. Oh. Well done. You've got through most of them there. Thank you once again, John, for joining me for the Bandit About podcast series today. You've been great to chat to, and I hope that everyone who listens finds this as enjoyable as I did. All of the information and links relating to today's interview can be located in the description field of this podcast. And please feel free to message me if you have any ideas or requests for future Bandit About podcast guests. And make sure that you subscribe or follow this series on your chosen podcast listening platform so that more people can discover how wonderful our drummers are. You can also leave a voice message for your favourite interview, which I can then attach to the interview for others to hear. So that's it from me. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
I hope you didn't find it too troubling an experience.
No, it was quite okay. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I appreciate the opportunity to do it. It's something that I've never heard of before, this podcast thing, so it's been great to do it, and I hope I haven't bored you too much.
Well, you haven't bored me. I've been laughing quite a bit.
You got to laugh. That's the main thing.
You do. It is the best medicine, and yeah,
life is too short.
True that.
Yeah, okay. That's right.
Well, until next week, it's goodbye from me, Di, Bandit About, proudly supporting live music. Hi, it's Di here. Did you know that you can help to support my podcast series by buying me a cup of coffee? Well, you do now. If you'd like to do this, please use the link that's in the show notes. Thank you for your support, and thank you for listening to the Bandit About podcast series. Bye.
Huge fan of John Stevens. Mates with him on Facebook. He's done amazing stuff for the SA music industry. Lachlan would love to get a kick out of John coming around and chanting up his kit. All right, cheers, bye.